Thank you for joining Michon Hadar's learning of Pirkei Avot in honor of our 10th year celebration. This week's Dvar Torah is by Rabbi Jason Rubinstein.
This week's Mishnayot are Parakei, Mishnayot He through Vav. Chapter 5, Mishnayot 5 and 6. We're continuing with the number 10. Asara nisim na'asu la'avoteinu b'beit hamikdash. There were 10 miracles that were done for our forefathers in the temple. Here they are. Number 1. Lo hipila isha me'reach b'sar hakodesh. No woman miscarried because of the power of the smell of the holy flesh. And this isn't referring to that for some reason, you know, powerful smells might cause a woman to miscarry, but it's actually referring to a larger legal tradition that if a pregnant woman has an extremely powerful craving for something that's forbidden, essentially, you let her have it. Because you don't know what that craving is about, and you basically feed her whatever she wants when she demands it. And so there's this recognition on the part of the rabbis that you don't mess with a pregnant woman's cravings. She knows her body, you just let her do what she wants to do. So it's a miracle that despite the fact that no pregnant women were given access to this sacrificial flesh and they could smell it from miles away, no woman desired that meat so badly and was denied access to it that she ended up having an unfortunately untimely miscarriage. We're continuing with the 10 miracles. We only done one. Miracle number 2. Velo hisriach besar hakodesh me'olam. And another casualty of meat is sometimes when you're roasting the meat, it smells amazing. But sometimes when the meat has been sitting out too long, it smells disgusting. So the second miracle was that the meat never stank. Third miracle, what else happens when you have a lot of meat? Well, meat tends to attract flies. But in the Beit HaMikdash, there was no fly to be found. No flies were seen in the slaughterhouse. Third, meat-related miracle. Now we're continuing on with different kinds of miracles. We're up to miracle number 4. That the Kohen Gadol did not ever experience a seminal emission on Yom Kippur. A seminal emission would have rendered the Kohen Gadol impure. And you really need a pure Kohen Gadol to be able to do all of the sacrifices and all of the ritual on Yom Kippur. So it's a miracle that no Kohen ever found himself suddenly, surprisingly impure. Miracle number 5. Velo kibu geshamim eish shalatzei ha-maracha. And the rains never were able to extinguish the fire that were on the arranged wood. Essentially, there's this notion that there's a continuous fire on the Mizbeach. And the Mizbeach is outdoors. And yet a miracle happened that despite weather conditions, the fire never went out. Velo natzcha haruach et amura ashan. And the wind never was victorious over the pillar of smoke. Love this image of the wind fighting the smoke. And the pillar of smoke is supposed to go straight up. And it never happened that the wind was so strong that it interfered with the pillar of smoke. Velo nimtza pesul ba'omer uveshte halechem uvelechem apanim. And there was never any disqualification found in these three sacrifices that are all related to grain. The omer sacrifice, where you bring the first barley, and that enables you to eat barley for the rest of the season. The shte halechem, which is made out of wheat, which enables you to eat wheat for the rest of the season. And the lechem hapanim, the showbread, the bread that is supposed to be constantly refreshed, so that there's never a time when there is no bread. These are all opportunities where if you messed it up, you can't get a second first barley. You can't get a second first wheat. And if something happens to the bread, you can't miraculously make new bread in enough time that the old bread won't have already gone. So all of these represent these kind of scary moments where if things don't go perfectly right, you're going to have this gap where you actually can't fix it. Next miracle. Omdim tzifufim u'mishtachavim revachim. People would be standing all squished together, but they would have enough room to bow. And in the Beit HaMikdash, we're imagining that people are actually bowing lying down. So even though when they're standing up, there's barely enough room for people to shuffle by, miraculously, there's enough room for people to all lie down on the ground. And no snake or scorpion ever caused anybody any damage in Yerushalayim, ever. It's a good promise. Velo amar adam lechaviro, and a person never said to his friend, Tzar li hamakom sha'alim b'Yerushalayim. There's no place for me to sleep over in Yerushalayim. It's Sukkot, it's Pesach, I need to go make pilgrimage Yerushalayim, but all of the hotels are all booked up. Never happened. There's always enough space for people to bow, and there's always enough space for people to sleep. Of course, the underside of this Mishnah, the reason why we need to be told that these miraculous things happened, is that the plain sense of what's going on in the Beit HaMikdash is actually a little smelly, a little bit bloody, and a little bit crowded. And what this Mishnah is saying is, you have to think about the Beit HaMikdash in its like cleanest, most pristine, most beautiful, most pleasant-smelling sense. Don't focus on the ways in which it's bloody, and the ways in which it's smelly, and the ways in which it's dirty. Actually, everything worked. There was enough space, and there were no flies, and there were no scorpions, and everybody was happy. We're continuing with Mishnah Vav, another set of 10. Asara divarim nivru b'erev Shabbat bein hashmashot. There were 10 things that were created on the eve of Shabbat. Bein hashmashot literally means between the suns, and this is essentially twilight. After the sun has gone down, but before the moon has totally come up, in this time where it's neither day nor night, this is the time the miracles happen. And so here are the 10 things that were created in the first twilight. Pi haaretz, the mouth of the land, when Korach had his rebellion against Moshe, the earth opened in a miraculous way and swallowed them up. That earth-opening mechanism was in place from the creation of the world. Pi ha-be'er, the mouth of the well. The fact that we had this miraculous source of water in the desert, preordained, that was created, twilight. Pi ha-aton, remember Bilam's talking donkey? She was taught how to talk? Erev Shabbat, bein hashmashot. Ve'ha-keshet, and the rainbow. Also put in place twilight before the first Shabbat. The Haman and the magical bread that fell from the heavens in the desert. Also, the Hamateh, Moshe's staff, with which he does incredible miracles. The Hashamir and the worm. Now, the worm is an interesting example. There are certain technicalities that come along with trying to fashion the stones, both of the building of the Beit HaMikdash and of the adornments of the Kohen Gadol's garments that can't be engraved in traditional ways. So the rabbis understood that actually the way that it was engraved was not with iron tools, God forbid, but with worms. The worm, the special shamir, the special worm came and basically nibbled out everything that needed to be engraved. Try to get your hands on one of these worms. You will be a millionaire. What else was created? Something else that was engraved, v'haktav, the writing, v'hamichtav, and the ability to write. So both the script and the ability to write, v'haluchot, and the tablets, right? Which are this perfect example of the miraculousness of writing, because they are described as having been engraved with the finger of God and being totally see-through from one end to the other. And despite that fact, if I looked from one side, it would always be written in the right direction. If I looked at the other side, it would always be written in the right direction. And all of the letters that have circles inside, like a mem sofit, like a samech, those little circles were held, suspended miraculously in the air from the time of Erev Shabbat, the first Shabbat. V'yesh amrim, and there are those that say, actually, it wasn't 10 things. It was 11. Af hamazikin, even the demons, were created on Erev Shabbat. U'kivurato shel Moshe, the secret place where Moshe is buried. V'elo shel Avraham Avinu, and the ram of Avraham, referring to this magical ram that appears out of nowhere after Avraham has been told that he's not supposed to sacrifice Isaac. He looks up and he sees there's a ram. Now, what's beautiful about this ram is that it's referred to the ram of Avraham Avinu, not as the ram of Yitzchak Avinu. Because even if Avraham hadn't seen this ram, Yitzchak would have been safe. The angel already said, Avraham, don't sacrifice your son. But this isle, this magical ram that was found stuck in the bushes, is what enabled Avraham to feel okay about that decision. It was really an isle for Avraham, that if he came to sacrifice, he wouldn't feel like a failure. There would be something for him to bind up and slaughter on the altar. V'yeshomrim, and there are those that say that there was a 14th thing that was created on Erev Shabbat, Bein Hashmashot, Aftzivat, even the tongs, Bitzvat Asuya, that have to be made with other tongs. Right, that essentially, if I am an iron worker, if I want to make a set of tongs out of this bright, red, hot steel or iron, I need to hold it with another set of tongs. Well, where did that set of tongs come from? Another set of tongs. And if you keep on going back, all of the tongs and the tongs, you end up with Erev Shabbat Bein Hashmashot.
This is Jason Rubenstein with Machon Hadar. We're here in Pirkei Avot, Chapter 5, and I want to spend the next few minutes thinking carefully with you about Mishnah Vav, the sixth Mishnah, which broaches the topic of miraculous events that occur in the course of our world and our time. The Mishnah lists 10, or perhaps 13, or perhaps 14 things that were the capstones, the makeb fatish, the finishing touches that God put on creation as the sun was setting on the sixth day, just before those primordial days of creation concluded and the inaugural Shabbat commenced. God, like most of us, it turns out, has many things to finish up in those last few seconds. The Mishnah reads, and I'll read in translation, 10 things were created on that first Erev Shabbat as the sun was setting, and here they are. 3 refer to mouths or points of transition that occur later in the biblical story. Pi ha'aretz, the mouth of the earth that opened to swallow Korach. Pi ha'be'er, the mouth of the well that was through Miriam's merit that provided for the Jewish people in the desert. Ufi ha'aton, and the mouth of the donkey that spoke and argued with and beat Bil'am in an argument in the farcical part of his story in Sefer Bamidbar. Next, we have 4 items that are critical to the covenantal events and development of the Torah. The first is the keshet, the rainbow that signals the covenant between Noah and his descendants and God after the flood. The second is the man that provides for the Jewish people in the desert. The third is the Mateh, Moshe Rabbeinu's staff that he used to split the sea and perform so many other works. And the fourth of these is the Shemir, the small worm that Shlomo HaMelech employed to hew the stones of the Mikdash, since, as we see in multiple places, metal tools could not be used and were not used in that process of construction. The last 3 of this first list, rounding out 10, have different interpretations, but they are closely related to the giving of the Torah, Haktav, HaMikhtav, HaLuchot. So Luchot is clearly the 2 tablets, the first 2 tablets that Moshe Rabbeinu broke, on which were for the first time inscribed the Torah. And something about either the text and the writing, or the writing and the letters, or something about the form of the writing, was also created initially at this moment in the last hours of the sixth day of creation, even though they didn't appear until a book and a half later. And now we get some possible additions, perhaps demons and Moshe Rabbeinu's burial place and the ram that Avraham Avinu sacrificed in place of his son Isaac. And then we also get a possible 14th member of the list, the original pair of tongs, since how can you make tongs without tongs? So there must be an initial pair. The main focus here is how these first 7 really are received in the suggestion that the Mishnah is making, that miraculous events that seem to occur in the course of subsequent generations, centuries, even millennia, are actually somehow foreordained and built into the work of creation from its earliest days, from the time period when God was
most directly involved in our world. And I want to take the next few minutes to look at how this idea is developed in very, very different directions by the Rambam Maimonides and Ramban Nachmanides. So for the Rambam, this is one of the most important Mishnayot in the whole corpus. And the reason for that is that for him, it signals the possibility that things that look like miracles in subsequent history look like direct intervention of God and contravention of the governing physical laws are in fact not disruptions of the natural order, but rather the unfolding of events that were preordained already in the first 6 days of creation. And the Rambam, in his comment on this Mishnah, gives the example of something that follows the pattern of this list, but actually he says happened on an earlier day of creation, the day when the upper and lower waters were split from one another. The Rambam says at that time, it was also ordained by God that the waters of the Sea of Reeds, the Yam Suf, would split at just the moment they did when Bnei Yisrael were crossing. And so what looked like a miraculous intervention at that moment on God's part was really nothing like that at all. It was simply the unfolding of the conditions that God had set up initially with the creation of the world. And whether or not the Israelites had arrived there at that time, the sea would have split nonetheless. And for the Rambam, this allows him to fundamentally rework the meanings of the word nature and miracle, since both of those, both nature and miracle, are actually things that occur in the orderly unfolding and application of the laws of nature. Nature then refers to things that happen frequently or regularly, and miracle is just what is surprising, unusual, or even unprecedented to our knowledge. So for the Rambam, the possibility of miracle is in some ways shrunk down and in some ways vastly, vastly expanded. Miracle is shrunk down in the sense that, well, there are no miracles if you define miracle as a present intervention of God in the course of nature. There was only the playing out of the work that God did in initially setting up the cosmos. And at the same time, miracles are expanded in a very, very large sense because it seems clear on the Rambam's interpretation that we haven't yet had all the miracles. Miracles will continue to be experienced, and the saving power, the potential of these 6 days of creation will continue to unfold in human life. We will continue to discover new riches, new surprises, new salvations that were always there in potential, always waiting for us to come along and experience and witness them. So for the Rambam, this really defines nature as the unfolding in a very orderly way of what was always possible there. The Ramban, Nachmanides, takes a different kind of approach because the problem that's bothering him is not the Rambam's problem. It's not a reconciliation of the possibility of divine agency and science that this Mishnah presents an opening to, but rather a different kind of, much more kind of first-person, everyday set of concerns. And the Ramban appeals, rather than to the kind of rationalism of Maimonides, to a certain kind of empiricism, a certain kind of emphasis on the integrity and importance of experience and perception, which I think isn't normally how he's understood, and that's why I want to really draw this out. So he makes this in two comments of his on the Torah. The first of these connected to the Keshet, the rainbow, that appears in our Mishnah. And the problem, according to him, is that the biblical narrative in Parashat Noach seems to describe the creation of a rainbow for the first time well after the 6 days of creation. And for him, this is a problem not with the Mishnah, but actually in terms of physics. And he says the following. He says, we are compelled to believe the words of the Greeks. Which words? Shemilahat ha-shemesh ba'avir halach yiyeh ha-keshet b'tolada. That the interaction of sunlight and humidity in the air produces the effect of a rainbow. This is a scientific property of how our world operates. And why are we compelled to believe that? Ki b'chli mayim lifnei ha-shemesh yireh kemar ha-keshet. When you place a glass with water in it in front of the sun, you'll see a spectrum on the far side of the glass, which looks exactly like a rainbow. Which means, for the Ramban, the problem is there must have been rainbows from the very, very beginning of time, since there was light and there was humidity. And therefore, how can God be creating a rainbow only here in Genesis chapter 9? And his solution to this, which you can read inside, is that the rainbow had existed from the beginning of time, but the significance of the rainbow as a marker of a covenant was newly added by God. For the Ramban, nature continues in its course, but what's created is new levels of significance. History and interaction and communication imbue nature with real meaning that it comes to have, but that it didn't intrinsically have. So the creative moment in the covenant after the flood is of God's sealing of the covenant and then designating a physical marker as the reminder and the symbol of that covenant. And the Ramban points out that this is what happens many, many times in different covenants that are made throughout Sefer Bereishit. Yaakov and Levan and the pile of rocks, with Avraham at Beersheba, with the seven sheep, etc. So the Ramban gives a picture of unfolding history here that's not just a playing out or development of initial conditions, but where divine and human activity don't just reveal, but actually create new layers of meaning that become part of the world we live in, on top of or in addition to the physical world. The second comment of the Ramban's, where he talks about this problematic, is in Parshat Shoftim, where the Torah prohibits a variety of kind of predictive and magical crafts. And he says an incredible thing. Rabim yitirasidu b'nechashim, lomar she'en b'hem emet klal. He says many people try to piously deny the efficacy of fortune-telling, saying there's no thing in it. Ki mi yagid la'arev v'la'agor mahiye. Who tells these different kinds of birds what will happen, such that by observing their patterns of flight, one can know the future? People like the Ramban, for example. Here is why the Ramban rejects that approach. He says, we cannot deny things that people have eyewitnessed. It's an amazing statement. He says, we have empirical evidence for the efficacy of fortune-telling and of these different predictive magical arts. And he goes on to explain the way that they work. And it involves a certain kind of cosmology that leads to really a kind of astrology. For the Ramban, like for so many before the advent of our science, the occurrences on our world in the sublunar world from the moon down to the earth are controlled by the superlunar realm, the motions of the stars and the constellations and the planets. And there's almost a one-to-one correspondence. You can imagine kind of puppet strings from up there driving what occurs down here. He says this is the way God set the world up. And God additionally built in a kind of back door so that God could make things happen in our world here on Earth without having to move the heavens around. And the example he gives is, let's say Jupiter controls the motion of the seas. Well, God didn't want to have to swing Jupiter across the sky in order to split the sea when the Jewish people needed to travel it. So God built in a backdoor mechanism just to be able to split the sea while Jupiter remains there at its current place in the sky, breaking the link between Jupiter and the seas. And for the Ramban, what happens in magic is that human beings figure out that backdoor and start manipulating nature in ways that really only God should have access to. This is a fascinating account and raises really interesting questions, both in the current cybersecurity debate about backdoors, and also in terms of our question about what the Ramban describes as magic, we may well call science. The key thing here I want to draw out is that for the Ramban, there's the possibility of ongoing agency and creativity and interaction in a way that parallels what he described as God's activity in adding signification to the rainbow itself. And so for the Ramban, history is not a process of discovering the potential, just merely watching the unfolding occurrences of the 6 days of creation that God set in motion. It's also an active set of events that God and human beings author and add new significance and change the shape of the world that was created. And in this sense, we get a very different picture, a much more empiricist picture, a much more contingent picture, a picture that takes into account our actions and our experiences in a way that isn't just limited to watching what God set in motion initially continue. And so I hope these two pictures give you some sense of where this Mishnah is going and a picture of how to experience the familiar and the miraculous in our lives. Yisher
koach. Next week's Mishnayot are Parakei, Chapter 5, Mishnayot Zayin through Tet, 7 through 9.
For more opportunities to be involved in our 10th year celebration, please visit mechonhadar.org/siyum. Join us on Thursday, March 2nd for our Siyum celebration and be a part of our first ever National Shabbaton for March 3rd through 5th, 2017.